Hey everyone, thanks for listening to Latino USA. So, when does learning begin? And are we really at the end of privacy? And what does the road from curiosity to discovery really look like? The TED Radio Hour is a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, and new ways to think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Wanting to understand why it was that my parents had put me on a plane is what led me to start wanting to construct a story.
Some histories are forgotten, while others are just never told. We hear about a confidential program that brought Cuban children to the U.S. in the 1960s. Was it a rescue, or was that the official story? And also, Chicano Batman, a band that is ready to let the country know who they are.
You know what? We're doing something that no other group's really doing right now, and America needs to know that we exist, you know? We don't just exist in the background.
Plus, one artist trying to help the Bay Area remember the dead. All this and more coming up on Latino USA as we ask this question: who tells the story? I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Maria de Los Angeles Torres, who goes by Nena, is a professor of Latino studies. When Nena was just 5 years old, Fidel Castro marched into Havana.
Castro follows a more leisurely itinerary to Havana. When he began this campaign with a handful of men, he said, "I will be a hero or a martyr." At 31, he's very much a hero.
In our home, my parents were supporters of Fidel. My parents hid rebels in our home. I remember, somebody even sleeping on our sofa. My father even joins the rebel army. He was a doctor, and so he was commissioned and was part of the group that took over the psychiatric hospital. Ordaz, who was the commander of the revolution, had gone to medical school with my father. Ordaz was a trumpet player. My father was a singer. They used to have musical events, and so on Sundays, we'd go out to the psychiatric hospital where there, you know, those long Cuban lunches, right, in the middle of the afternoon.
Una nueva emoción vibra en mi corazón.
Then little by little, they started noticing things that really disturbed them. What really shocked them were the firing squads. Parallel to that victorious, marching into Havana, which I do remember, okay, los barbudos with the rosaries, around their necks and, kissing everybody and everybody being very happy. Parallel to that, start a series of summary trials that ended up in firing squads.
The revolution was not what Nina's parents thought it would be. Fidel Castro wasn't holding democratic elections as he promised. And the violence reminded Nena's parents of another dark time in Cuban history.
And at least in my family, particularly in my mother's family, her grandfather had fought against the Spaniards and had been tortured by the Spaniards. The Spaniards were very brutal. And so there was this memory, I think, in Cubans of what a cruel government could be. And I think a lot of the people that had supported the revolution ended up being scared of what was happening.
People who feared what the revolution was turning into joined together to form an underground network.
As the underground started to grow, the repression also started to grow.
Nena was a child, but she could sense the anxiety around her.
The end of my block was a park, and, I remember kids where the mothers would sort of sit around and whisper to each other, didn't know what they were whispering about, ends up they were whispering on how to get out.
Days before the Bay of Pigs, a failed invasion of Cuba sponsored by the U.S., Nina's school closed down.
And I remember that we were very scared. There were, I want to say, avionetas, little small planes. There were bombings. And my parents decide that they need to leave Cuba.
In the early 60s, the U.S. government rolled out a visa waiver program to protect the children of Castro dissidents. It was called Operation Peter Pan, or Pedro Pan. The idea was to fly children into Miami and place them with relatives or foster parents, or even in orphanages, until they could be reunited with their parents.
At some point, my mother says, you're going to be traveling to Miami, and you're going to be staying with a family who I knew a little, but not really, and we will be coming later. I remember packing the suitcase. I do remember being woken up very early in the morning and being put in the back seat of the car and being driven to the airport. There was a big sort of glass divider, you know, between those who were traveling and those that were at the airport. And, you know, people would still be touching, you know, and looking for their parents and their parents for the kids. I don't quite remember that, but I do remember walking out to the runway and being stopped by a guard. And he tried to take my doll away. And I apparently either, you know, looked at him angrily or, you know, took it back. And he let me go with my doll. I didn't know. At the time, there were people who sometimes, you know, put their valuable jewelry, because it was something that was being taken away from people, in with their, you know, in the hems of the dresses or in the dolls. This is something that I've sort of debated with other people. I mean, I remember the plane was filled with kids. And, you know, people say, oh, this was a secret operation. It could have been filled with kids. Well, it was filled with kids.
Over 14,000 kids came to the U.S. through Operation Pedro Pan.
This was such a familiar way to leave the country. I was not the only one who left this way. My cousins left like this. Many of my cousins, the kids on my block, were leaving this way.
Luckily for Nina, it wasn't long before she was reunited with her parents.
My parents came within 3 months, 4 months.
Nina's parents never regretted the move to the States, but life here wasn't that easy.
I had ended up in Midland, Texas, where we had, you know, our windows were shot. We were told to go back to where we came from.
Nina remembers being pulled out of public pools. Some kids even burned the shape of a cross into her family's lawn, just for being Cuban. Her family knew what it was like to be targeted, but not like this. For Nina, it was isolating. People didn't seem to understand the complexities of her experience.
It's like walking through life without having a mirror, right? Never seeing yourself reflected in what is being told about history or events that you lived through, that your parents lived through, your cousins lived through, and not seeing yourself reflected in that history.
For a long time, Operation Pedro Pan wasn't covered by the media. Even now, a lot of people in the U.S. have never heard of it.
This was a classified operation, at least in its origins, until 1962, when the Cleveland plane dealer breaks the story.
The story then got picked up by other papers.
It comes out in the Miami Herald under the title of 8,000 children at the time being saved from brainwashing.
But Nina's own experience didn't fit neatly into this description.
Then Operation Pedro Pan becomes a sort of a heroic saving the children from communism. This was the only way that people could leave the country. When in reality, at least I knew through my own family and increasingly as I met other Pedro Pans, that, you know, we hadn't necessarily been saved.
When Nina reached adulthood and became a professor of Latino studies, she decided to fill in the gaps of her childhood memories and find out what really happened.
Wanting to understand why it was that my parents had put me on a plane is what led me to start wanting to construct a story. And I thought it would be, you know, a short story, right? You know, interview a couple families, starting with mine, interview the parents, you know, why is it that you did this? And it really led into all sorts of different avenues.
Full of all the complexities of breaking up families and foregoing a normal childhood.
Many had suffered serious abuses, emotional distancing from their parents. Some had not seen their parents in 20 years because as the situation unfolded, both Cuba shut the doors to the children being able to go back, and the United States, because of the missile crisis, shuts the door to Cubans.
What Nena was finding fell in line with other stories coming out about Operation Pedro Pan. One of the most famous people to go through the program, artist Ana Mendieta, talked about how her and her sister ended up in Iowa.
Pero la cosa fue que mi hermana y yo éramos las criaditas de la familia y teníamos que limpiar y lavar los platos, etcétera, mientras que los hijos de ella no lo hacían.
Mendieta said that she was placed with a German family and that she and her sister were treated like the help. They'd have to clean the dishes and do chores that the other children didn't have to do. Nena even spoke to one woman who was sexually abused by her foster father.
And, you know, the mother to this day denies that that happened to her daughter. For her, there's too much pain involved in facing the consequences, if you will, of her decision by the way, her daughter doesn't, no se lo reclama, okay? She understands why her mother did that. But I think that there's so much pain that it's very hard for people to step out of the neatly packaged, heroic act to understand that it's messier than that.
Of course, not all the Pedro Pan children had bad experiences. Operation Pedro Pan Group, Incorporated, is a charitable organization founded by former Cuban children who came to the U.S. through the program. The group acknowledges that some kids did suffer abuse. They say that no one has done an empirical study, but they estimate that it's less than 1%. They also maintain that the children who came through Pedro Pan and were put into foster homes or orphanages got better care than American kids placed there. A full statement by the Operation Pedro Pan group can be found on our website. Nena never set out to tell a story about victims or heroes. She was just trying to get the larger picture. And that's what she dedicates herself to as a professor of Latino studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's even the executive director of the Inter-University Program for Latino Research, known as IUPLR, a complex name for an organization with a complex mission that includes undercutting stereotypes through academia.
The paradigms that say that we're lazy, that we don't work, that we don't care, that, you know, we don't want to speak English, et cetera, those paradigms need to be changed. And the only way you can change those is by producing new knowledge.
And to produce new knowledge, you need to look at issues through many different perspectives.
We are at a point where we need to really complicate these stories, right? And we need to complicate the fact that, you know, not all Latinos think one way or another. There is no such thing as a model Latino or a model that can, through which everything can be explained.
And that's what today's show is all about. There's never one right narrative or story, but rather many narratives and many stories. And there can be consequences when people can't tell their own story or when one story becomes the official story. So today, we explore this question, who tells the story?
Quiero recordar la...
Coming up on Latino USA.
We just finished wheat pasting a poster on a trash can here, and we totally did not notice a police officer walking the street. I was almost about to book it, man.
An artist who pays tribute to the forgotten, no matter the risk. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Tabaco y caña, verán, donde el sur.
que impuso y que se pega, y cuando llega no despega, pega, pega lo que puso el ruso en el discurso que con país segundo puso entre tus cejas.
Ahora la distancia queda.
Si de mi lengua estoy viviendo y calmando mi fiel tristeza, ¿de qué forma quieres tú que yo detenga la sangre de amor y patria que me corre por las venas? Generaciones vieja y nueva, de corazón, sangre y pulmón.
Hola, mis queridos listeners, it's Maria, and I have a couple of favors to ask you. Now, if you listen to us on iTunes, it's really simple. If you just take a couple of minutes, rate and review our show. It really does help us a lot. And if you really love what we do here, and this also takes just a couple of seconds, go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button. Even just 10, 20, 50 bucks from everyone who listens to us would make a very big difference for us in making the radio that you love. Muchas gracias.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And Americans for the Arts, for more than half a century committed to building better communities and better lives through the arts, in partnership with local, state, and national leaders. Learn more at americansforthearts.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Back in April, we were shocked by the story of Onísimo López Ramos, an 18-year-old Guatemalan immigrant who was beaten to death by three young white men in the town of Jupiter, Florida. The news of his death didn't sweep the nation, even though police there called López Ramos' murder a hate crime, said that he was targeted and killed because he was Latino and an immigrant. WLRN's Maria Muriel gives us this update now from the community in Jupiter.
The town of Jupiter is the opposite of what its name suggests. It's small, less than 60,000 people, roughly an hour north of Miami. Onésimo López Ramos lived here on 4th Street. It looks like a peaceful neighborhood, but on April 18th, this was the scene of a murder. Different accounts say Onésimo was getting home from work when Jesse Harris, his brother David Harris, and their friend Austin Taggart started calling to him. They all talked for a while, and then the white men attacked Onésimo with a blunt object that may have been a rock. He died of injuries to the face and head. The crime surprised people here. There's plenty of outreach for immigrants in Jupiter. A community center called El Sol celebrates holidays and organizes soccer games with the police department.
We put on the soccer tournament so that we could, you know, take off our police officer uniforms, put on a soccer uniform, and just interact with the community in a positive way.
That's Jupiter Police Spokesman Officer Adam Brown.
You know, we just wanted to show the members of our community that we're normal people, good people, just like anybody else, and that we're approachable.
That relationship helped police investigate Onésimo's murder. And Police Chief Frank Kitsura recognized that at a press conference.
Over the years, we here in Jupiter have fostered a great relationship with our Hispanic community. Those lasting relationships and the willingness of people to come forward played a significant role in this case.
Besides that, one of the suspects, Austin Taggart, told the police he and the other men were out doing something they called guat hunting, meaning they were looking for immigrants to beat up. The police chief pressed for the crime to be considered hate motivated. The suspects are being charged with first-degree murder.
Specifically targeted members of our Hispanic community. And this began as a premeditated robbery. We are looking for the hate crime enhancements during the penalty phase.
Still, 2 months after Onésimo's death, some Guatemalans in Jupiter are skittish. Three undocumented men at El Sol won't go on tape. They tell me they're sometimes harassed by Americanos, but won't take the trouble or the risk of reporting it to the police. They say police take longer to respond to calls from immigrants anyway, or they might not show up. But one man does want to talk. Joel Perez knew Onésimo personally. They both came from the same village in Guatemala. He says Onésimo was a humble boy who worked two jobs at least 10 hours a day. Joel says he thinks most Americans in Jupiter love and appreciate other cultures, but not everyone is that way.
In
his 10 years here, Coyle has been harassed a couple of times, followed by a truck full of white guys, even chased once. The truck cornered Joel and his brother in a dark shopping plaza, but they ran away and found iron bars to defend themselves. Then the other guys left them alone. Joel says another time when the police did come, a fight broke out anyway. He says the worst part was that the kids' parents were just sitting outside watching it go on. But Joel is philosophical about the situation. He thinks there are good and bad people everywhere. The problem, he says, is some parents don't teach their children love and tolerance. And that's why Officer Brown says the police are trying to protect the rights of people who are victimized.
The last thing we want is for someone who is a victim of a crime to be hesitant to come forward and report it. All members of our community are very important to us, not just one segment.
So it seems there is some trust to build on here. But there's still a long way to go before all Guatemalans in Jupiter feel comfortable going out at night. For Latino USA, I'm Maria Muriel.
So joining us now to talk about how the media has covered this story and the reactions from Latino rights groups is our very own Julio Ricardo Varela. He's the digital director here at Futuro Media and our social media expert. Julio, welcome back.
Hey, Maria, how are you?
I'm great. So, Julio, pretty serious stuff here. How has this been talked about? How much?
It really hasn't been talked about a lot, Maria, outside of maybe Univision and Telemundo, which you would know that would happen. There was, I believe there was a story in Fusion when it came out. I know Latino Rebels did it, and the story took off, and it was shared on social media. But in terms of, like, front page, you know, New York Times, Washington Post stories, even the Miami Herald, which is close to Jupiter, or even places in that, there wasn't a lot of this, considering the nature of the crime and the fact that the Jupiter police clearly labeled it a hate crime. And then the chatter comes from social media where people see that and people are becoming informed through that. And that's actually how we at Latino USA found out about the story. And that's how I pitched it to the group. So we're getting more from social and digital media than we are from the mainstream. And sadly, it doesn't surprise me.
One of the things that might change that dynamic if there was pressure from Latino groups, from civil rights organizations. I mean, this isn't the first time that we've seen immigrants getting targeted. So where are the Latino rights organizations? Is there pressure?
I haven't seen any, Maria, specifically about this case. Again, it feels to me, and we've talked about this before. This is one of the themes that we always seem to come back to when we talk about what these rights organizations are focusing on. I think the immigration issue is still so huge and hasn't been resolved that a lot of resources are moving there. So then when incidents like this happen in Jupiter, there's not a mobilization of these rights organizations. They still feel a little bit detached from the community. And what's happened is that you start seeing social media and digital media try to fill that void. But in terms of the reach and the resources of these civil rights organizations, there still seems to be a big disconnect, whether it's political, whether it's the intense focus on immigration reform, which is very important. But the complete picture is not here. When you talk about the consequences of immigration reform not being passed and the misperceptions are out there where you see someone, you know, you see a tragedy that happened in Jupiter because he's Guatemalan, he has cash on him, he's easy prey, he's undocumented, so he's not going to, you know, the community's not going to report back. That's where, you know, that's the part of this entire narrative that's not getting discussed.
And there's also the relationship between immigrant communities, undocumented peoples to the police. This is something we've talked a lot about on Latino USA. But the question is that are Latinos internalizing essentially the fear and saying, as we heard in this story, why would we go tell the police?
Right. And you take the case of the hate crime in Jupiter, like the police came after and said, we want to hear from you guys. We want to reach out And there was still this sense of distrust. And it's still this sense of, you know, if, especially communities like that, where if I speak out, will my life change for the worse? You know, will I be back in Guatemala in 2 weeks? So it's not only, you know, not speaking out in the local community, but it's not even getting the support from other Latino community. I mean, that's the part that's mind-boggling in all this, is you would think that more media outlets, specifically in Spanish, specifically that cater to the U.S. Latino demographic or news consumer, would have been all over this story, would have been following it every day. That just was not there. And so within the Latino community, are we supporting each other when it comes to something as horrific as what happened?
Julio, complicated story. I'm glad that we're covering it here at Latino USA and giving it the attention it deserves.
Always here. Un placer, Maria. Gracias.
We reached out to three of the largest Latino rights groups, MALDEF, LULAC, and the National Council of La Raza, and asked them why there hadn't been any statements on López Ramos' murder, but we didn't hear back from any of them. If you're a listener to our show, then you know that we often talk about why some stories about killings of unarmed people of color get told and others don't. We found an artist in California who's trying to keep the memories of victims alive for everyone to see. If you walk the streets of the San Francisco Bay Area, you'll see simple black and white posters of unarmed black and brown people who've been killed. They're pasted across building walls, store windows, and telephone poles. They're made by the Oakland-based artist Ori Original. Reporter Todd Whitney tagged along with him in San Francisco's Mission District for a night of wheat pasting, gluing the portraits onto every available surface.
We just finished wheat pasting a poster on a trash can here, and we totally did not notice a police officer walking the street. I was almost about to book it, man. My name is Ori Original, and I'm a visual artist who is originally from Los Angeles, now residing in Oakland. So tonight we're gonna be walking around the Mission and try to find some spots to weep paste some posters. I have some Mike Brown and Eric Garner prints. If a cop sees me, of course I'm gonna run. I'm pretty agile, so I could get away, and I've ran many times in the past, so. Usually you would want to start off with applying the wheat paste onto the wall and then pasting the poster on top and then applying the wheat paste on top of it again. What inspired me to work on these designs was the situation that was happening Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, when George Zimmerman was not found guilty for killing Trayvon. That's sort of the time when the Black Lives Matter movement began. So the portraits that I do are very simple. I pull up an image on a Google, so I usually use the more iconic images that are shared of these victims, and I upload it onto Photoshop, and I pretty much trace it. The images that I've been doing are black and white, so I don't add any color or much design to them, and that was so that people would be able to alter these images a lot easier, as opposed to if it was an image that has a lot of layers to it, then it would be a lot more difficult to work with the image. And another reason is because I'm profiling people that have been killed. So these are also our ancestors. And I like to depict that with just black and white. I know that there's people that do have issues with seeing these posters out in the streets, because I've passed by some of the ones that I've posted where people have torn off certain parts of the poster, like they would take off the black in the part where it says Black Lives Matter. So this is pretty much a similar approach where I'm bringing it to people's faces whether they like it or not. Whenever I see people holding up my artwork, like at the Millions March or at other protests, it makes me feel like the work that I'm doing is fulfilling its purpose. I feel that it's the reason why people are using these images is not because of the talent that I'm infusing into these designs, but it's the names of these people and the stories of these people is the reason why people are using these images. These people matter, the people that are being portrayed in these designs. This is my contribution to the movement.
Reporter Todd Whitney in San Francisco. Now, when it comes to questioning the narrative on the internet, few people are as frank about it as Aisha Siddiqui. Through her many online avenues, usually under the name Pushing Hoops, Aisha Siddiqui became known for her directness and her intellect when discussing racism, sexism, and pop culture. I spoke to her a year ago when she was heading up BuzzFeed Ideas. She's since gone on to become the editor-in-chief of The New Inquiry, an independent online publication focused on cultural criticism. Aisha Siddiqui joins us now to talk about independence on the internet and who gets to tell this story. Aisha, welcome back to Latino USA.
Thank you so much for having me back.
So last time you were here, you worked at BuzzFeed. You left BuzzFeed, and now you are the editor-in-chief of The New Inquiry. Mm-hmm. So for our listeners who don't know the website, New Inquiry, what's it about? Because this whole show is about who's telling the stories.
You know, The New Inquiry is such an encouraging experiment that started out being founded purely on the premise that is there a way for a new generation, particularly women, particularly people who don't typically have access to spaces doing contemporary literary criticism, can they establish a publication that's taken seriously? And since then, it's been about 5 years, we've managed to support ourselves entirely through subscriptions and reader donations. We're ad-free and paywall-free. And as we expand the project, as we commission more work, publish pieces on covering riots, you know, white supremacy, colonialism, imperialism, you know, a publication that isn't afraid to delve deep into topics that are typically positioned as being quite niche, it's been so remarkably encouraging to find ourselves with a significant audience and an audience that's willing to support us. You know, in this era of do-it-yourself independent media, so much of the platforms and websites that are created to sort of enable DIY culture, Tumblr, Twitter, blogging platforms, it's really the content that other people are generating that's making these spaces exciting and interesting. It's easy to forget that there are actual CEOs and the fact that these platforms are big corporations. And so we're very lucky to be able to develop our own internal payment processing system that's going to allow people to sign up directly. But it just is one of the lessons that you learn trying to produce an independent publication. You know, what the nature of independence is online when you're still in various ways indebted to these corporate platforms.
So Twitter, Facebook, getting, of course, huge activity. But if it wasn't for people, mm-hmm. and oftentimes conversations that are being led by people of color, mm-hmm. if that wasn't being posted on Twitter, then you're saying basically, what would Twitter be?
Absolutely. They are really just harvesting the information that they're having us provide in these very murky terms of consent and surveillance.
Do you feel that the corporate platforms ultimately have an impact in how the story is told?
You know, Facebook's algorithms, they suppress and promote whichever story they like. So if there's a story that they don't like or that's critical of them, then it's nothing for them to have that not show up on your newsfeed. So it's this idea of people far removed from the editorial process having their hands on the lever and being this intermediary between your audience and your output.
The relationship between audience and output. something we think about a lot here at Latino USA. And coming up, more of my conversation with Aisha Siddiqui.
Again, one of the classic words of conversations on race and politics is like tolerance, right? And that very, very low standard of living with one another is like, just tolerate them.
Stay with us. No se vayan. Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. So when does learning begin? And are we really at the end of privacy? And what does the road from curiosity to discovery really look like? The TED Radio Hour is a journey through fascinating ideas, astonishing inventions, and new ways to think and create. Find the TED Radio Hour podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org, and the Simons Foundation, working to advance research in basic science and mathematics. More information is available online at simonsfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I've been speaking with Aisha Siddiqui, the editor-in-chief of the hyper-smart online magazine, The New Inquiry. At heart, Aisha is a cultural critic, so I asked her for her thoughts on some of television's more diverse shows. All right, so we're coming off what's been called one of the most diverse television seasons. You know, the buzz is that this is what it was all about, right? A particular lineup on ABC, that, you know, Fresh Off the Boat, Modern Family, Blackish. Do you really agree that the last television season was, in fact, this kind of multi-culti arrival? Or are you more critical of it than that?
I mean, I think Modern Family is an interesting show to include because in many ways it was initially billed and continues to be celebrated for being something that was going to shake up all of the other very staid, typical family sitcom. But really what that show does is that, okay, a lot of these new identities that more mainstream middle of America might increasingly be encountering, whether in the news or in other shows on cable, it kind of tries to dissolve any resulting challenge to audiences that aren't used to these identities by operating through very familiar, comfortable tropes. So firstly, the gay couple on the show, Cam and Mitchell, they embody gay stereotypes. And then you have the character of Gloria, who, while it's really exciting that's how Sofia Vergara is one of the, you know, highest paid actresses on television, she embodies a lot of the very archaic stereotypes of the Latina bombshell. A lot of the jokes involve her accent being the punchline. Or then you have, you know, the frazzled, overbearing wife and the well-intentioned, bumbling husband. And then you have the patriarch presiding over this entire clan, the husband to Gloria. And he's in many ways almost a surrogate for, I think, the audience that the show is aimed at. He's the one who sort of, you know, sits back and towards the camera, talks about not being able to understand his wife's accent, or, you know, just shrugs at what he sees as particularly effeminate habits of his gay son.
I mean, the way you're describing it, it's like, wow, it's not very modern at all.
Right. I mean, really, the only modern thing about it is that I remember the show first started. It was like, nothing about this show strikes me as new other than the fact that the kids on the show are using iPads.
So what shows are you watching now that, or have you watched recently that you're like, okay, this is interesting?
Right. So when I started watching Jane the Virgin, I was absolutely delighted by so many things that the universe of the show takes for granted and is entirely unapologetic about. The fact that everyone on the show has Spanish names that aren't ones that, you know, might be anglicized or easier to pronounce for non-Spanish speakers. The fact that there are really only two white characters to the show, two or three at a time. It wasn't just those elements, it was the fact that it was an homage to the telenovela and introduced so many of the conventions of that genre to people who may not have been familiar with them.
If Luisa doesn't come back in 2 weeks, then you get a default judgment against her.
I should pause to point out that Jane had no idea that Rafael's hotel was on the line, and he wasn't about to tell her.
We have a hacienda in Mexico.
It's great to see that the show is successful across the board, and that the fact that the show is able to do all of the things that you would imagine getting shot down in a pitch meeting, right? Or having producers be like, oh, we can't greenlight this, who's going to watch it? It's wonderful that that show has been critically acclaimed. Its lead has won a Golden Globe, it's been renewed for another season. It's really cool to see a show like that do so well.
Let's talk about a show that has been renewed, Black-ish. So let's take a listen to one of the clips.
Santa was the first white man I ever loved, followed by a close second, Terry Bradshaw. But back to Santa. I love Santa so much because I never got to believe in him as a kid.
Look who Santa brought me, Daddy.
Uh-uh. You better get out of here with that. That was from me and your daddy. You think some fat white man showed up on Jesus' birthday and gave you those full-price socks? I don't think so.
So we had a writer review the show for us at the New Inquiry, and it was really interesting that one of the writer's points was about how this show deals with the politics of respectability. Again, one of the classic words of conversations on race and politics is, like, tolerance, right? And that very, very low standard of living with one another is, like, just tolerate them. And the parallels between this show and its timing versus The Cosby Show are really interesting. And I think speak to a really awkward moment in the television landscape. Shonda Rhimes is worth crediting in any conversation about race and television for championing actors of color and writing really compelling and successful dramas featuring them.
And you've got I think to myself, of course, I'm a big fan of hers and all of her shows. And I'm just like, but there's got to be more than just one Shonda Rhimes,
yeah,
right? I mean,
yeah.
There's got to be more, but where are they?
And there's almost an impulse to sort of be satisfied with her success and think, well, we have Shonda Rhimes, you know, we had Scandal, we have these shows, isn't that good enough? And it's like, no, if you can still, like, name, not just on one hand, but just that one person, that is not a mark of success. It's a mark of how much more remains to be done.
A lot of people have talked about the Mindy Project, spoke about the Mindy Project as a real success. Let's take a listen to one of the clips.
Hey, Dr. Gargler, you went to medical school with Danny Castellano, right?
Yeah.
Well, he's my boyfriend.
Yeah, I knew him, Dan. I always did like Hispanic girls.
Well, I'm... Okay, yeah, okay, doesn't matter. But he's still in town, maybe you want to hang out.
So the thing about Mindy Kaling is, of course, I just walked by a newsstand. She's on the cover of InStyle magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Big deal. Her show just got canceled.
It did.
But it just got picked up by Hulu.
Yeah.
In your view, though, I mean, the fact that she went to Hulu, is that really the point? Which is to say, you know what, big television networks, you're not getting it. The places that are getting it and that will distribute and get to this audience are Hulu.
I can't remember if the last time I watched The Mindy Project, I always watched it through Hulu. So I don't think that's a shift that's going to be particularly salient to fans of this show. But it is worth considering the fact that it was canceled when it's strange to see a lot of white comics like Tina Fey and Amy Schumer being given credit that implies that they're doing something necessary for the culture, that by virtue of being women, they've already accomplished something. And part of what we're talking about, the success and failings of shows that are traditionally more difficult to get on air, it's about how these metrics of success aren't equally applicable across the board, and how true success, the way I see it, it's worth celebrating when it ensures more after itself, right? When it's not allowed to be a one-off novelty, which is why I'm so hesitant and wary to be okay with just one Shonda Rhimes or to be call to celebrate the fact that, well, at least Sofia Vergara is on the air and not consider the terms of the material she's given and what that means for other Latino actresses that also want to pursue consistent work. And, I mean, the question that's always, I think, most relevant to me across the board in work is, what are you doing that ensures not only the people after you, but people are going to be able to do more? That should be the end goal. And that's what my criticism of Modern Family are really about, is that by, you know, demanding that we be satisfied with the window dressing and the packaging, lets everyone off the hook for opening the doors for so many more people and so much more good, compelling, creative work.
Aisha, thank you so much for coming back and joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Aisha Siddiqui is the editor-in-chief of the New Inquiry. She also has a podcast called Pushing Hoops with Sticks, which you can find on iTunes. And you can find her daily thoughts on Twitter, where she uses the handle @PushingHoops. Everybody has a story, but few of us get the chance to go on stage and tell our stories in front of thousands of people. The band Chicano Batman has been getting that chance a lot these days. The group is made up of four Latino kids from Southern California. They'd been building steam playing local shows in LA when suddenly they caught a few big breaks. First, they were invited to play the massive Coachella Music Festival. Then, a few days later, they landed a spot touring with Jack White. The audiences were much bigger, and that proved to be more challenging than you might think. Their story is today's sabiduría, or words of wisdom.
My name is Bardo Martinez. I play the guitar, the organ, and I sing in Chicano Batman.
Hi, my name is Carlos Arevalo, and I play guitar in Chicano Batman.
My name is Eduardo Arenas, and I play bass in Chicano Batman. Chicano Batman is a musical force that draws from, like, generations from the past, like this nostalgic vibe.
Mexican cumbia, you know, I'm talking about, like, Rigo Tobar.
Latin American soul groups like Los Pasteles Verdes, there's Los Angeles Negros.
You know, things that you grow up sleeping to when you're a little kid, like, you know, at the quinceañera when your parents are still dancing and you're ready to go home. You know what I'm saying?
Then there's references that any guitar player would appreciate. Jimi Hendrix, I guess you could say Led Zeppelin.
Caetano Veloso and the Tropicalia movement from the late 60s. That movement was so on point.
And yeah, it's just the sound that we bring is just an accumulation of all of our influences, and it just sounds like Chicano Batman.
We started playing together since 2008.
We were playing a bunch of club gigs in LA bars and really saturating the scene. And
we eventually, you know, landed opening with Jack White.
Jack's in. Let's do it. Here are the dates. We leave in 2 weeks.
So we were playing sold out shows for Jack White.
I remember the first show we did in Austin, Texas.
We arrived in Austin like around 4 p.m. and there was folks just lined around the building. It was nuts. Like, wow, it just makes you feel, it basically makes you feel the enormity of the event. It was the first time we ever played in front of so many people.
You just look out, everybody's screaming, and it kind of hits you because you think everybody's not going to like you because you're a weird band. You know, you sing songs in Spanish. You can't make up your mind about what genre you're doing. You don't fit into any kind of category.
People are there to see Jack White, and you could feel it. You know, you're playing a play halfway through the set, and you're like, wow. You know, you could feel, like, the tension. But I think we held people's attention the whole way, you know. We just poured our souls out there.
We played great. Jack came into the dressing room right after the performance and was like, wow, that was amazing, you know. So this is one of many reviews we got. The first one, actually, before I go into this, was the Austin Chronicle. And they wrote us a terrible review. There's no mention of our music. It's just the way we look and what we're wearing.
Just kind of like focusing on how different we were from Jack White. And Jack White towered over the audience and, you know, was a grand god, you know.
So this one came up next, and this is, I believe, from... What was it? This was after we played Starkville, Mississippi. It came from Alabama newspaper, I believe. And this is what the review said. The first band was called Chicano Batman from Los Angeles.
They were just as weird as the name sounds.
All four members came out dressed in powder blue ruffled shirts. The singer looked like a mixture of Weird Al and Jesus.
At some point, the singer started playing Spanish salsa songs.
And he was not easily understood because he was singing in Spanish as well. It was different.
It was really funny for us, some of us, because some of us took it more personal than others.
His grammar and writing's terrible, you know?
For me, I thought it's a great piece. Not in journalism, right? But I think in kind of establishing the status quo about how people are processing who we are, where we're at, and where we're going.
That was the first time ever in print being criticized for who we were.
You know, it was something where it was like, wow, I need to call my mom. Like, I need to talk to my people. I need anybody. Somebody give me some energy. Somebody give me some positivity.
And that really made me think, wow, we're so accepted in LA, and what we do is just nonchalant. You know, people accept it. Oh, they're singing bilingual. That's fine. You know, that's how we communicate out here. We don't think twice about it. We don't question it. And then you get out to these other places, and it's not like that at all. And people do question that, and they question your validity because of that. But after that passed, that feeling of discouragement, that's when, yeah, it kicked in. Like, you know what? We're doing something that no other group's really doing right now, and America needs to know that we exist, you know? We don't just exist in the background. Here we are. We're on stage, brown people playing this music.
This is the new generation. You know, this is us. I mean, we represent a lot of people. We represent a growing movement and an identity. And this is the future. We're the future, you know? And I feel like that.
We obviously come from, you know, different parts of Latin America, our families, you know? But for the most part, we're an American band. And to some people, that kind of trips them out. Wow, this is the new face of America. Wow, this kind of makes me uncomfortable. But it shouldn't make them uncomfortable, you know? So we're just doing our thing, and we just want to bring as much, you know, love with our music as we can to people. And hopefully, I think people that see that, they get it, you know, and they can put those fears aside.
You know, people come out to the shows, they sing our songs. And it's special. It's really special because I never had a chance to look up to a band that I really admired musically and just on so many levels because they were, you know, raza, because they were Latinos. I think when we play a stage and people say, you know, you make me really proud to be Mexican because seeing you guys up on that stage makes me feel really empowered. I mean, they're seeing a reflection of themselves, you know, up when they see us. And, well, that's great. That's amazing.
Take a trip along with us. And road ain't breaking what we must in order to feel lost. A prison in the cloud.
Chicano Batman's most recent album is called Cycles of Existential Rhyme. Do yourselves a favor and check it out. It's pretty awesome.
Searching like wolf for our minds, melting into the magma. So when memory was a woman, magma would be her name. And I call it and I ask her, magma, what was the first words I said? And why did I say them? Magma, you know, cause you melted my bones and my brains. I see you later. When I dream.
And that's it for this week, mis queridos y queridas. Latino USA is produced by Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, Antonia Cerejido, and Julia Alsop. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Nancy Trujillo is the one who makes it all happen. Our new summer interns are Gabriela Sierra Alonso and Isabel Riofrío and Madeline Johnson. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram, Maria_la_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
A very cinematographic...
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Inada, Japanese maker of full-body massage chairs, including the Flex 3S with pre-programmed shiatsu massages and full-body stretch sessions at inadausa.com. That's INIDAUSA.com. And Heather Sturthaga and Paul G. Haga, supporting Salzburg Global Seminar, which works to challenge current and future leaders to solve issues of global concern. Learn more at salzburgglobal.org. This is NPR.